You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Nina Weissman. Nina, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Let's begin with what you're working on now. There's a few projects I want to discuss about your work so the listeners really understand where you're coming from and all the things that your work can bring together. But why don't we start with what's your current project?
So the project that I'm working on right now is building on what I've done before, but it's going off into some new territory for me. I felt like it was time to do that. And so it's called the Laboratory for Embodied Intelligences, and this will be, it's wonderfully, generously funded now by the 18th Street Arts Center in Santa Monica, and they have funding from the Irvine Foundation and the California Council for the Arts and Santa Monica also. And anyway, so there, I'll be an artist in residence there, and they've commissioned this work, which is, I would say a huge percentage of it is research, but research with the community that will lead to performances and public events. And so, as I said, it's called the Laboratory for Embodied Intelligences, and what I'm looking into, and with other people who are interested in looking into this, so that would be like artists, dancers, movers of all kinds, scientists, and then different groups from the community there, we're looking into how we could think about intelligence from a non or less anthropocentric view, because science and most humans, not just scientists, have a tendency to think that we own intelligence or that ours is incredibly special. And on the other hand, we're getting, as our tools get a little sharper, if you're coming at it from a scientific perspective, we're starting to learn a lot about intelligence across the animal kingdom, in the plant kingdom, and there are some who are talking about it among single cell creatures, microbes and bacteria. And I'm very excited about that.
How does that research, because that's very interesting, and I'd like to know more about that kind of research, but then how will that play out in your project that's being commissioned there? What will it end up being, and how will some of those ideas or other ideas get to the audience?
Mm-hmm. So what we're going to be, like I said, we're going to be working with the community, with different groups. So because in order to understand a little bit about microbial intelligence, I think with all creatures, we think through our bodies, whatever they may be, through our sensory organs and the other physical things we have available to us. So one of the big challenges of this, or one of the interests, is to try to get access to the embodied sense of a microbe or the world view of a microbe from a physical perspective. And so I'm really interested in not just working with dancers and movers, as I said, but also people whose senses are maybe more highly tuned in some areas than most of us. So for example, blind people, perhaps people with some challenges with certain kinds of movement who are therefore, you know, focused on their bodies in different ways. People who look into, people who do Tai Chi or who look into mind-body healing. So a lot of people who use their bodies in sort of slightly non-conventional ways. And we will together develop the works that will be presented to the public. So we have a few ideas already about some locations.
Well, let me stop you. Let me just stop you right there. When you say we, who is exactly we, and how many people will collaborate and decide this, and how are the collaborators chosen?
So right now, I've been working most closely with Flora Wiegman, who's a wonderful choreographer and dancer who's based in Los Angeles. I've also been working a lot with Juliana Snapper, who is an opera singer who's been noted, and I think the Huffington Post called her one of the 14 people who are changing the nature of opera right now, who's done an underwater opera and sung opera hanging upside down, very interested in pushing the limits of the voice. And then I ran this think tank at the end of December up at Montalvo in the LucasArtist program, where I had a mix of scientists and other artists working on some of these questions. And so I'll draw from some of those folks too. So I have an aerialist, Nahara Kalev, perhaps Felipe Zuniga, who's an educator based in Mexico City and a wonderful performance artist, perhaps Jenny Donovan, another artist based in San Diego, a couple of dancers, Mariah Evans in New York, Nicole Peisel based in Northern California. But I'm expanding because I started to develop in Northern California, now I'm based in L.A., you're catching me very early in the what's it going to be phase, so I'm just starting to research and look out to find who, what movers and people I'll be collaborating with in LA. So it could become a much larger group, but I think the primary people will probably be myself, Flora, Juliana, and a couple of scientists that I can mention as we go along.
Okay. Let's talk about perhaps one of the, to relate it to this, and we could even come back to what you're working on as it feeds into it, but I'd like to talk about one or two past works, maybe Between the Bodies could be the first one.
Okay, sure. So what I've been doing for the last 12, 14 years, I've been making, not entirely, but many interactive sound installations. And those pieces, I use in all of them different kinds of sensors. They might be infrared sensors that are posted about in the space. They might be microphones on the floor, various sensors that pick up people's natural movements in the space. So when someone crosses paths with the sensor, they will either trigger sound or create sound, but not just trigger it, it will change with their movement. And so the space becomes a kind of instrument that they play with their bodies. But they needn't be dancers or anything. So, for example, with Between Bodies, this was a commission for the Secut Museum in Tijuana. It was for a new international wing of that museum, and this was for the entrance, which was about a 75-foot-long entrance, like a funnel-shaped entrance. So you enter the wide end, and you're funneled. That's about 15 feet wide. You're funneled down to about 6 feet and then released into the museum. And as you funnel down that entrance, light is dimmed, all the color and life of the city is sort of shut out, and then you sort of get spit into the museum where I guess the idea is like truth or something is revealed to you. It feels a little like walking into a tomb in some way. So I wanted to bring the life of the city back into the museum, and because it's very, very rich life in Tijuana, visually and sonically. So I used these sensors and peppered them through the walkway so that the first ones you couldn't avoid but to trigger them. You would have to trigger them. After that, it was a choice. You could choose to trigger them or not. You could walk and avoid them or go through them. To go through them would be to not follow the sort of the walk that the architecture is demanding, which is a sort of straight line, but instead would require you to weave and to take more time to engage with the sound and the space in a different way. And most people would do that. And what they would hear would be sounds that I gathered on the street all over Tijuana, sounds from all kinds of neighborhoods, all different economic backgrounds. So sounds of work, sounds of play, sounds in wealthy areas, sounds in neighborhoods with no electricity or no water, et cetera. And so these are sounds of bodies at work or at play on the street. I wanted to capture the street life because this was a time when the drug wars were generating some crime in the city, but that crime was being grossly overreported and had destroyed the economy so that the tourism industry, which is huge there, had dropped to 5% of what it had been because the life in the city was so misrepresented. So I wanted to sort of present the beauty of this life on the street that's not being represented. So you would hear sounds of people hammering, making tortillas, typing, jump roping, and sounds of, all kinds of sounds like this. But when you trigger it, again, like if it's a hammering sound, you would be changing the pitch or speed as you move. So it becomes like a kind of instrument you can play. Each sound is that way, but you can hear it very clearly for the sound that it is in a certain position. So people could identify the sounds. And in identifying them, they tend to this is, you know, people talk now, there's been a lot of research about the mirror neuron system in our brains. And by virtue of when you hear the sound of someone doing something, your body will take on that same action unconsciously. But to a large degree, meaning your muscles will be primed to do that action and the same neurons will fire in your brain as if you're doing it. So you virtually enact this act that you're hearing. So if I hear someone hammering, I become a virtual hammerer. And it's a survival tool. It's a way, something that's hardwired in us so that we can, I can understand if you're about to attack me or I can learn from you, but it also generates an immediate empathy. It can be very useful in doing this. And so that was a big interest I had there, was to try to generate some empathy between people who didn't know the city and people who are coming to visit it. I'm sorry, people who are visiting the city and people who live there. So I showed the piece in Tijuana, and when people from the city engaged with it, they had a very emotional response because they recognized the sounds as their own, the sounds of their city that they hadn't been walking around it very much because they were so frightened by the reporting that was going on. When I showed it in Orange County, California, which is a very conservative community, people had, many people had ideas that they didn't like Mexicans and that, that they had a lot of prejudices, but they wouldn't know what these sounds were when they first walked in. They would just play and engage with them and have this kind of subtle subconscious empathy generated. And at the end, there would be a list of what the sound sources were, many of which pointed to our economic dependence on the labor of people in Tijuana. So there were sounds of also people typing about toxic waste dumping by U.S. companies or of people making parts for equipment, et cetera. So some people told me, I mean, they changed their minds a little bit about their relationship to people.
Right, so that's really creating empathy on two levels. The first, empathetic, I guess, gesture of feeling is not as conscious as the second one, where you're ascribing literal value to what it is. So that it sounds like the first door opening allows for the second door, so to speak.
No, that's great. You're right. Exactly. And I'm really interested. I think I'm almost all my work over the last 15 years has been like that, where the entry point is a place of play and very easy to access. So you hear a sound and you play, or you see an image and you realize you can change it by moving, or you see a performance. So very accessible. But then over time, then there's it's like with a painting. If you spend 2 seconds, well, you get a very quick read on it. But if you spend some time, then some of these meanings start to get teased out. And so I try, and all the pieces, they are motivated by interests like this piece in Tijuana or other pieces about surveillance or about the orange industry or different concerns and different pieces to also tease out some ideas that are important to think about now.
So. And then I'd like to talk about some more work, but to also give a context to how you approach all these things. You know, you're in Tijuana or in L.A. or projects happening in different places. How do all these projects come about? How do you get invited, or are you applying for a lot of things, or is what the main way that all of this happens for you? Because you're operating in a way outside the market a bit, so to speak, right? Most of these don't have an obvious component for sale. Is that correct?
That is extremely correct. Yeah. So it's hard. I occasionally will show in a gallery, but generally galleries need to pay their rent, and so they need to show things that are they can sell, and those are generally much more traditional, you know, i.e. a painting or a sculpture or occasional video. So I mostly am showing in museums and public spaces, and people have been asking me. That's the mostly how it's happened. In a couple of cases I applied. I think I'm not so good at writing applications, so that I've written more, I've written more than I've, like anybody, than I've been offered, but most of the projects I've done have just been offers from people who have seen my work or commissions or requests to do something. So the new Children's Museum in San Diego, they had seen a work at Orange County Museum of Art. So they requested a piece, and, you know, so that I get a commission to work. And what there's, we'll see. I mean, it's sort of always like that. I did a piece in Berlin, and then somebody saw another version of that piece, and that's how the Secoute project came about. So it's mostly, yeah, just from, I guess, the first few that I showed, maybe more as a grad student. I went back to school kind of late in my life, and I got a couple pieces out the way grad students always do, you know, in a museum, in the school gallery, or in a kind of low-key festival, and those were seen, and then that started to get me into places that could actually help support the pieces and the work.
And before we go, is there another project we should talk about that would bring about another facet of your approach besides the two we discussed?
Sure, yes. Well, I could tell you about this piece called Displacement, and that is a piece that I've made a couple of versions of it, and actually I made the first one in grad school and then adjusted it, made new versions over time, but that is a path. It's a series of, it's a modular path made of these wood tiles, so I can assemble it in all different ways to suit the space that it's in. And it works two ways. Version one is that when you walk your footstep, you hear it first right with you, but as you continue to walk down the path, the playback of your footstep is pulled away from you in time. So there's an increasing delay. And it's also pulled away from you in space, or it shuttles around. And I was interested in this idea of how technology might sort of take away your body envelope, your bodily expectations, the very fundamental ones. And it's a very strange feeling. So so as you walk around this room, you lose control over the timing and placement of your footstep. And it provoked a lot of interesting reactions from people, some playful, some people got... I ended up in these kind of monologues with their own walk, a kind of a meditative monologue. Some people got really freaked out and felt like they were being followed by technology and by themselves. And then I made another version of the piece where you walk in other sounds. In fact, they were recordings of from high heels that evolve into like a troop of marching boots. Those two sounds are clear, and in between it's a sort of sound morph between those. And whether some people realized what the sounds were, some just understood the quality of the sound, the sort of poppy sound of the high heels and the sort of heavy, much more brittle sound of the boots. And so they would describe viscerally the same kind of feeling, feeling very, very light and then very kind of regimented and locked in and heavy at the end. That's, I think, a kind of nice example of how this mirror neuron thing can work in a really fundamental way, where you would identify directly with another body. So with this new work that I didn't give you a very clear description of what it will be yet, because I don't know, a big part of what we'll be doing is working on embodying the qualities that, or properties, capacities that microbes have, such as they're very porous. So things flow through their cell membranes in a much easier way than we think happens through our body. But we can find points of commonality with this porousness through our own skin, where it turns out we have 650 sweat glands per square inch and 1,000 nerves per square inch. And we don't really turn our attention to that dense system for sensing and excreting, but it's there. And so I'm working with people. We're starting to turn our attention there and finding that you can start to sense some of this, and that can give you a kind of empathy, we hope, with the microbes, and we'll see what it leads to. We think it's going to lead to performances. We're taking on some of the movements of microbes. They have very particular kinds of movements that they do, and logics for very efficient exploration of space. There's many concrete things that they do that we would like to, we will try out and see what we learn from them, how doing those things impacts our thinking.
And when you say we, these are your collaborators, or or you're speaking in kind of larger art audience that interacts?
So it will be both, but it'll be my collaborators, but then we will, as I was mentioning, we're going to reach out to this community. It's this grant wants us to work in Santa Monica, and so we'll reach out to people there. I'm thinking that we'll be reaching out to kids, but then also to people who very serious movers and performances whose bodies are very tuned to, and, you know, who they're very tuned to moving and sensing with their bodies. And to the possibly the group of blind folks there who would also be very tuned to certain kind of senses, so that they could work with us, help us develop these kinds of sensitivities and the kind of movements that are appropriate. And then with them, we'll probably do some performances. And through the work with them, we should also generate interventions in larger public settings, such as the Metro, which runs through Santa Monica and then off through the city. We're thinking about taking on, in some ways, some of this microbial social behavior and seeing if it might diffuse out into people who are riding the Metro or people at the beach. We're thinking about that as a site. We're thinking also about the campus of the 18th Street Arts Center as a site when they have lots of bodies there. So we're looking to see if we can't plant sort of movement and interactive means based on microbial behaviors, because microbes have successfully thrived on the planet for 3.5 billion years by dialoguing with each other in a much more democratic way than we do. And so I think there's a lot we can learn by studying them carefully. So that's really the motivation behind this.
Well, that's interesting because microbes are also kind of the building blocks of so much kind of genetic modification now that artists are using as well as others, but modifying microbes is what seems to be happening a lot as well, that that can change everything from, you know, how they behave with other cells and to all kinds of what seems like futuristic notions of what a human being can be or do.
Yeah. No, right, with CRISPR, I think you're probably alluding to that, this technique of gene splicing. It takes up the technique that microbes invented, you know, maybe 3 billion years ago. Sometime around then, where they swap DNA by sort of penetrating each other's cell membranes and passing to the neighboring microbe what's needed there, and vice versa. They pass little bits of DNA back and forth to each other and incorporate them. So they share much more than we do in this way. But it's an interesting prospect when you have humans making these decisions about what's going to be changed. That's not, you know, the jury's out. Is that part of like a natural evolutionary process, or is that a little faster than it was meant to happen? You know, what are the repercussions?
It's not evolutionary at all. I mean, you know, the book that I'm reading, Regenesis, by a geneticist who's kind of spearheading the whole movement, George Church, or one of the many. It's making microbes do things they wouldn't normally do. Like one of the things is literally reprogramming, not just gene swapping, but recoding the instructions that the microbes have to do what job they're programmed to do. And, you know, in some cases, they're programmed to turn plants into plastic. That's what the kind of, you know, plant-based plastic is. It's actually kind of the excrement from microbes who are reprogrammed to digest differently, actually. And the other one, I mean, there's many more, but, you know, training microbes to turn, instead of spending a lot of money on fuel to treat sewage waste, they're using microbes now that are reprogrammed, that are, you know, literally like going in there and switching around instructions so that they can treat sewage and also generate electricity at the same time. And,
right.
And you know, save more money, but it's not evolutionary at all. It's something that it's almost like microbes are being used as basic building blocks that can be manipulated to do almost anything. And in this one book, he's saying, just as it, you know an egg from, let's say, a dinosaur can has enough instructions in this one little mushy egg to turn to build a whole dinosaur with multiple organs and feet and a brain and everything that potentially, you know, a genetically modified series of microbes in something like an egg could build an entire house by itself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It kind of amazes me, you know, quite
yeah.
a lot. So.
Yeah, it was like the nanofactory, you know, that I think like it's gotten more specific now, you know, that was sort of the thought with nanotechnology. And then now, yeah, when it runs up against even better, if you can be working with living matter, then it can happen even faster. I guess the good thing, I'm reading this great book now, Microcosmos by Lynn Margulis. It's not new. I think it was, I don't know when it came out, like in the 90s or something, maybe earlier. Oh, 86. And she talks about, you know, on the one hand, it can be a little frightening when you, I think it's great. And I've been talking to some of these scientists who are working on, having microbes that sort of feed on the toxins, the heavy metals that we throw into water and all the toxins that we create and then put out something beneficial to us. So that, it sounds really great. I think the tricky thing is that the balance on the planet is so amazingly brilliant and I think not that delicate, but nevertheless, it's very complex. And microbes have done an amazing job and they're given credit in this book and by most biologists for maintaining the temperature, the atmosphere, the balance of gases, et cetera, on this planet. And so when we start doing these kind of fixes, you know, we're not so great at thinking long term. But the good thing is the microbes are, so even if we mess up, there'll still be, I think, a huge micro party in the end, like even if we botch it.
Yes, I think there will. So I was going to ask you what books you're reading, and you mentioned one. Is there any other book you'd want to share with us that you've been reading lately?
I've also been reading some science fiction. Yeah, I feel like I haven't done justice to the sort of science fiction end of my interest. So I'll tell you about the book first and then I'll tell you why, but it's called Filter House and it's a collection of short stories by Niecy Shaw, an African-American female writer. And they're really beautiful, brilliant writing. And just the kind of, you know, maybe it's a certain classic use of science fiction to imagine either a better world or to rewrite history or to expose the tragic history, and a lot of it connected to racism in this country and around the world. There's just a lot of beautiful inventions and very pointed metaphors in these stories. I highly recommend it. But I'm looking at that because the trigger for this work for me was I was a resident and artist in residence at SETI Institute last year. That's the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And so what set all this interest in microbes off for me was I came in there with a question, well, if you're searching for extraterrestrial intelligence, who's defining intelligence? How are you defining it? And as I spoke to scientists, it turned out there were almost as many definitions for intelligence as there are scientists, or not quite, but nobody agrees fundamentally, which is great. What they do agree on is that most of the life out there that they will find will be microbial in nature. And so if that's the case, I thought, well, then shouldn't we be looking for what kind of intelligence there we can find in microbes here and see if we can learn to fathom it? Can we even learn to communicate with it? As you pointed out, with these techniques like CRISPR, we're certainly learning to intervene with it, but it's not a dialogue, it's an intervention. So I think we could, you know, like I say, both we could stand to learn a lot from the microbes who've done a much better job at not messing up life balance on this planet than we have, and also it could make us able to communicate with the microbial life we will find out in space, which would be really fun.
That would be fun. Nina, it's been great talking with you. Is there any other examples that you wanted to give or something that we didn't say so far?
Well, you know, thanks for asking. I realized that I just want to give you one little concrete thought we had for the kind of performances that might come out of this this project with 18th Street Arts Center with from our Laboratory of Embodied Intelligences. And we're thinking about using the Metro as a model of cyanobacteria. And cyanobacteria are very brilliant bacteria who made the Earth livable for all of us who live here now, all the plants and animals, because they created oxygen. They learned how to create. They learned photosynthesis. They invented it. They didn't learn it. And so, and they continue to generate lots of oxygen on the planet. And they move in a really magnificent way. If you watch them, it's like gliding. They're long. It's a bunch of cells assembled together like a train, like a subway, lots of cars hooked up together, and they move in these very graceful, sort of slightly curved patterns, and they move alongside each other or bounce off of each other, but very gently, and it looks like an overhead view maybe of a complex overpass of freeways in Los Angeles. And we're fascinated by how are they doing this and how are they communicating with each other to facilitate this very, cooperative kind of movement. Scientists don't know how they're moving also. They haven't been able to understand the mechanism of their movement yet. So that's an area where we're starting to work on this kind of quorum sensing, which a lot of bacteria do, where they communicate with each other using chemicals. So, of course, they don't talk. They don't make visual signs to each other. So we're working to develop a kind of just barely touching system among movers, bodies in a space as a way to pass movement or to pass a way of moving along through a group. And so we're going to probably experiment with that in the Metro. And it will get more defined over time, but the form lends itself. And so that's one example of something we might do.
I'm glad you mentioned that example. That's helpful. Nina, I want to thank you for talking to me today. It's really been a pleasure to know more about your work.
Thank you. Thank you so much for asking me. I really enjoyed it.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.